From the Sky News Centre at 6, Alan Johnson is the surprise new Shadow Chancellor in Ed Miliband's first Shadow Cabinet. He gets the role ahead of Ed Balls or Yvette Cooper. Mr Balls has been named Shadow Home Secretary, his wife Shadow Foreign. Mr Johnson, a former postman and the oldest member of Mr Miliband's top team, must now take on the government over its planned cuts programme.
It's my job, together with Ed and the Shadow Cabinet, to put forward a real alternative. We think there is a different way to do this. Yes, it's going to be tough, but we think the government are cutting too deeply, too quickly.
The main rescue shaft at the collapsed Chile mine should reach the trapped miners within 24 hours. Engineers are now just 34 metres away. The 33 men have now been down there for 64 days. There are conflicting reports about the seriousness of Hungary's toxic sludge spill. Seven people are now reported to have died as a result of the reservoir and a metals plant bursting on Tuesday. Authorities say pH levels in the River Danube are normal, but Greenpeace say there are high levels of pollution. A passport office in South Wales is to close with the loss of 250 jobs. The Public and Commercial Services Union says the move will have devastating consequences for the local economy in Newport. The union claims more jobs are under threat at interview offices across the UK. In football, Scotland kick off a night of Euro 2012 qualifying action in just over an hour. They're in the Czech Republic. For Wales, Brian Flynn's in caretaker charge when they host Bulgaria. He's been trying to bring a smile back to his players in training this week.
Well, enjoyment is part of doing good preparation, doing good work. If you're enjoying yourself, your work is always going to be better.
Northern Ireland are at home to Italy, while the Republic of Ireland have Russia. And John Lennon's widow Yoko Ono will tell people to learn to love each other in peace as they celebrate what would have been his 70th birthday. Fans around the world will be remembering the late Beatle at various locations tomorrow. That's the latest. I'm Kevin Gover.
Bristol Community FM 93.2.
John Peel was a man of many talents. His Radio 1 sessions and championing of new music brought him international fame. But another passion was stories, told by ordinary folk on his Radio 4 programme Home Truths. As idiosyncratic and original as its presenter, Home Truths became a Saturday morning institution. At 5 o'clock on Monday the 11th of October, as part of BCFM's John Peel Day, we'll be revisiting some of the stories and people he took such delight in talking to, as well as hearing from some of the production team of this hugely popular radio show. BCFM John Peel Day, Monday 11th of October from 10 a.m. to 1 a.m. on 93.2. Keeping it real, keeping it Peel.
Welcome back to Friday Drive Time with old Labour economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. The Evening Post reported yesterday that we have at least 40 men and women rough sleeping in the nooks and crannies of Bristol city centre. It's getting colder every night now and we're facing a winter of benefit cuts and potential job losses. Isn't our wealthy society able to house people anymore? If the recession makes you a squatter in your own home, if the mortgage company tells you to get out, what are your rights? And if the money dries up, how do you feed the family? If you hit the bottom, is it really possible to bounce back up again? Well, Ben Ritchie from Bristol Squatter Network BAM and Paul Hazelden from the Wild Goose Free Cafe on City Road are here to tell it like it is, hopefully. Well, Paul and Ben, welcome to Drive Time.
Thank you.
Now, first you, Paul. Can you tell us what exactly Crisis Centre Ministries is?
Well, Crisis Centre is a Christian charity working with homeless people in St Paul's. We've been going since 1984 and we work with anybody really, but primarily with folk who are homeless, people who have got problems with drink, with drugs, mental health problems, problems with the law, all kinds of stuff like that.
Now, it must be difficult to say we don't turn people away because there must be potentially people who are quite disruptive as well.
Yes, we get folk who are normally very disruptive, but they know that if there is any trouble, then we just have to close the premises. And so there's quite a lot of incentive for people to behave themselves well, and they generally do, and they treat the other folk around and the staff and the volunteers with a good deal of respect most of the time.
Now, it sounds like quite a tough job to me. What brought you to this job?
That's a very long story, but it's a complete accident. I happened to be in the wrong place at the wrong time, and I knew the chair of the trustees at the point where the previous guy who ran the place was having to give up due to health problems. So I just stepped in for a short while to keep the place going.
So tell me, how many days a week is the Wild Goose Cafe open, and where is it?
At present, we're open Monday to Friday, lunchtime and evenings. We have been opening Saturday mornings, but we need more volunteers to make that possible again. And we're based in City Road in St Paul's.
And how are you funded?
We are funded almost entirely through voluntary donations and contributions. We apply to a few grants and try and get some money through trusts and that sort of thing, but most of the money comes in through to individual donations.
And to what extent do you have paid people, and to what extent do you rely on volunteer helpers?
We have normally 8 members of staff, most of whom work part-time, and we about 140 regular volunteers. So most of the work is done through the volunteers, and the staff are there to support and resource and encourage the volunteers and help them to do the work of getting to know the homeless people.
So in your experience, what actually makes people homeless in the first place?
Oh, it's a wide variety of different situations. Everybody's story is different, and there's some common roots. People could be a marriage breakup, as a result of that, people end up in a bedsit and start drinking and lose their job. It could be mental health problems. It could be problems with drugs that cause people to lose their jobs. There's all kinds of routes, but some fairly big problems that I think most folk would recognise that are the normal routes.
Now, there was an article in yesterday's Bristol Evening Post by Liz Webster. At least 40, apparently, will sleep on Bristol streets, she says, including at least 5 women, apparently, will be forced to sleep rough on Bristol streets every night. That is the claim made by Alan Goddard from the Crisis Centre Ministries. You're also, part of that, which conducted a count of the city's homeless on Monday night this week. Now, how often do you do those counts of the homeless, Paul?
Well, this is the first one we've done for quite a few years. There's counts being done on a regular basis, but they're mostly done by council staff, and they follow fairly restricted guidelines. So we've been participating in unofficial counts for a while, and this is the first time we went out and did a count as such ourselves.
But by its very nature, obviously, homeless people who are sleeping rough on the streets try and tuck themselves away, hide themselves away. How on earth can you find them all?
Well, this is where having a relationship with them helps. So you talk with them, you find out where they're planning to sleep tonight, and then you can go around and hopefully find them.
And how does your count match up with the Bristol City Council's official count?
It's not really doing the same thing at all. The official count, you can only count people who are bedded down and sleeping in easily reached places in close to the city centre. So we're going to find the people. So Alan and the folk with him went out to some Lee Woods, for example, because quite a number of people sleep out there. That's not part of the usual count route.
And how easy have you found it to actually find the people? Because I know you're saying that they're coming in maybe for food as well, and you actually got a relationship with them. But are you pretty confident then that this figure of 40 people a night sleeping out rough is pretty accurate?
Well, we generally reckon about 40 people is our expectation. Alan actually found 21 people sleeping rough that night, plus another 18 who were sleeping in the Julian Trust night shelter. So 5 nights a week that's open, 2 nights a week it's not open, so those 18 have nowhere to go.
Oh, that's why we're talking about 40. Yeah, okay.
Well, but in addition to that, we only managed to find about half the people that we were expecting to locate. So, so about 21 that we found, there's another 20 odd that we were expecting to find, plus 18 who actually had somewhere on a temporary basis that night.
So you're saying that the figures may be even higher?
It could be. 2 nights a week, it could well be.
Okay, so what provision actually is there for people who need a night shelter desperately, haven't got anywhere to stay, and how does that all work?
At the moment, there is only one facility, and that's the Julian Trust, that is open on a self-referral basis. Everything else, you need to get in touch with somebody from the council or one of the official agencies who will then refer you to accommodation. That said, the people who work in the hostels tend to be fairly friendly and sympathetic. So if you make contact and there is space, then the staff will often find a way if they can. but there rarely is space.
So how does Bristol's provision for the homeless, that is to say, you know, little shelters like the Student Trust mm-hmm. place and the free food, how does that compare to other cities around Britain?
Bristol's usually recognised as having one of the biggest problems with homelessness in the country, per capita outside London. So it's generally thought to be a rich city. So there's good facilities and people are well off. So the begging is, you know, fairly successful, and there's good facilities for homeless people, there's good drug treatment facilities and so on. So there's a lot of reasons why people come to Bristol and why they stay around.
And who, other than yourself, on City Road at the Wild Goose Cafe, who else around the city provides free food for people who just simply don't have the money to buy food?
Well, there's probably about a dozen different organisations. Most of them are smaller than us, but there's a soup run that operates, the Bristol Soup Run Trust, every night of the week on two locations in the city. So that is the main alternate provision. But a lot of other groups provide sandwiches. A number of churches provide some sort of service from their doors. Sisters of the Church do in City Road. St Nicholas of Tolentino. Trinity Tabernacle provide a breakfast every week. Salvation Army provide various meals. So there's a lot of different organisations, and of course the Bristol Methodist Centre provide food from their centre in Midland Road.
And now, what about ways out of homelessness? Are you able to help the people that arrive maybe fresh into the city at your cafe? Are you able to provide them with help to actually get a roof over their heads?
Generally speaking, yes. You know, we have a lot of contact with a lot of different organisations and a lot of individuals who have accommodation and who can maybe find jobs and so on. So it's all to do, it's all about who you know and the contacts you have and making appropriate links with people. So you link individuals up with the folk who are suitable to help them. And that takes quite a lot of background knowledge and experience, but yes, we can do it very often.
Okay, so I mean, for example, if someone is, you know, arrives at your cafe, is rough sleeping, how long might it take them to actually find that they've finally got a roof over their heads?
Well, it depends entirely on the individual and whether they turn up to interviews and all that sort of thing. So, you know, sometimes, you know, you can find somewhere for them the next day. Sometimes it takes weeks and weeks. And sadly, quite a few folk don't actually want to cooperate. So it can take an awful long time for them.
Why do you think that is?
A whole bunch of reasons again. Mental illness is clearly a factor for quite a number of these folk. Suspicion and bad experiences of folk in authority is another reason. And people have been hurt and let down sort of repeatedly and consistently, find it very hard to trust and receive help. So there's a whole bunch of different reasons.
Now, I think it's probably fair to say many of these people are very damaged people. Why is it, you think, we're hearing quite regularly from the police that they're having to deal with increasing numbers of people, criminals, who are actually really, more importantly, should be classed as potentially anyway, mentally ill. Mm-hmm. Why is it that we're seeing so many more mentally ill people on the streets, do you think?
Well, we're not funding the mental health services sufficiently. I mean, that's, you know, I think everybody involved with the health service recognises that sort of mental health is the Cinderella of the service. We starve the mental health services of the funds they need to actually go out and help the people who need it. Once people are receiving help, generally speaking, the quality of the help they receive is very, very good. But getting to the point where the mental health service accepts you as a service user is a massive struggle, and most people just can't cope with it and they can't achieve it. So most of the people who need help do not receive it.
Now, what about a sort of DIY solution? That is, when people are homeless and for whatever reason they haven't been able to get anywhere through people like yourself, Paul, and what do you think? Do you think there is actually a role for squatting, for people actually just finding empty buildings and living in those? Surely that's better than them actually sleeping in a shop doorway.
It's quite a large number of our folk do squat. They Yes, and there's a wide variety of experiences. So, you know, squatting can be everything from being in what's essentially a derelict building through to living in a home that you wouldn't recognise as being anything different from a normal home owner occupier. So it's a vast variety of different experiences there. And obviously the people who've got it their lives together more are able to, you know, do things like, you know, connecting to electricity and paying bills and all the normal things that you'd expect. And the folk who can't get it together are tending towards the sleep, you know, trying to find somewhere that's not actually running with water to put the sleeping bag down in.
Now, do you find that some people are better at doing the squatting and other people just can't cope with it?
Well, squatting is not an easy option. I mean, I don't know what people's imagination is like, but I mean, there aren't these sort of mini palaces, sort of with open doors that you can walk into and find.
Well, we do see in the Daily Mail, for example, that quite a lot of places up in London, in Mayfair, even have been squatted.
Yeah, well, that's not that's a bit outside our experience. I'm sure the people of Mayfair have got views on that, but the folk in Bristol, on the whole. People who are living in normal accommodation, really, there's not much connection with squatting, you know, for them. There are some property developers who choose to leave property unused for years on end. And I just can't see the moral justification for doing that when there are people living on the streets. And as a response to a deliberate maintaining properties being empty, it seems to me squatting is a perfectly valid response to the that irresponsible choice not to use such properties.
Well, we are also joined by Ben Ritchie from Bristol Housing Action Movement. Hi, Ben. Now, hi, can Ben. You tell us when Bristol Housing Action Movement was first formed?
Well, rather oddly, it was formed in exactly the same time as Paul's group. That was 1984. It was resuscitated, rather. So we've been going for a long time, and we've encountered almost all the issues that Paul has just outlined.
Now, I think many people just think that actually squatting is illegal now.
Squatting is still legal. There's a distinction between the criminal and the civil law. It's unlawful under civil law, so it's a form of trespass. That means that if you do get taken to court for squatting, you'll go to a civil court, you won't be facing normally criminal penalties, and you'll simply be asked to leave the property. There are other exceptions which we can go into.
So that's really, you know, it means that the police aren't involved, basically, doesn't it?
Well, that's the ideal situation. Often the police seem to take upon themselves regarding squatting as quasi-criminal. They usually arrest people in a minority of cases and then release them some hours later, but also they'll bail them and not charge them during this time. So because it's a controversial issue and it's not very sensitively dealt with by the police, some squatters do end up being arrested, but it's a minority.
Now, we've just heard from Paul that Bristol's a city in Britain which has got probably a very large proportion of homeless people. So can you give us an idea of how many people are actually squatting right now here in Bristol?
Well, it's at least about 150 to 200 people. That's roughly according to our estimates, which we make a monthly count, and we go by a number of properties occupied and then multiply it by a number that we think is a suitable occupation number. So that's the kind of figure I'd give.
So once a squatter has found an empty building and has actually changed the locks, does that mean that they're then in there legally?
They are. They've got to be very careful not to cause any really obvious criminal damage. So if, for example, you were to go out tonight, smash a window, climb in and put a legal warning up, I think you'd be given a rather grim time by the police because you've obviously damaged that property.
So the building's got to be actually open in some way already, has it? Whether it's a window or something like that?
I'm not going to give any trade secrets here, but basically you get into the building not causing any obvious damage. Why would you want to? You want to live there. You don't want to upset people. You want to get in there and as far as possible lead a normal life. So yes, no damage.
And what is your actual legal protection? You say putting up a warning, a squatter's warning on the door, did you say?
That's not the protection. That's just a reminder to anybody that turns up, the police, the owner, anybody else who might have a problem with you being there. You have some legal protection. It's called a Section 6. Basically, your legal protection is that to get you out, the owner or their agent must go to court, the civil court procedure I outlined. There are fast procedures, which we can go into if you want, but in all cases, they should go to court to get you out.
So it's a sort of two-stage thing. Either it's a process which will take a few weeks, or else there's a fast-track process, you're saying?
There are three fast-track processes, I think. The first is when the person who's squatting unfortunately goes into a house where somebody's living. That's a displaced residential occupier.
Now, we've seen quite a few stories, actually, in the national press over the last few weeks of squatters actually taking over someone's house while they're out shopping.
Well, this is like the railway crash. Mostly, you travel on the train, there are no crashes. The newspapers love problems, don't they? But these are very rare issues to deal with squatting. Most people go out of their way to avoid occupied houses. It happens occasionally. It often happens where unscrupulous people have taken over the property and rented it out to other unfortunate people who think it's an empty property. What happens then is that very quickly the police can be called and the owner, and displaced residential occupier proceedings can occur. Usually it takes up to a maximum of a week. The easiest way is for the person who is in the property, who lives there properly, to say to the people who've just come in, look, I live here. And most squatters are reasonable people and go, okay, we'll leave. We're not going to make you homeless because we're homeless. So there are two angles on any situation with a dispute. You can either go down the legal channel, or you can actually try and be a reasonable human being. What we challenge and what the police should support us in is the idea of self-help eviction, which basically leads to the Wild West and sort of punch-ups, which just pointless, really.
Now, I think maybe you're painting a bit of a rosy picture of the squatting movement here, because aren't some of these squats simply like crack houses and drug dens?
If you're going to deal drugs, why not deal it from a secure premise? Why do it from somewhere insecure where you've already marked yourself? So there may be the odd crack den that squatted. This used to be very common in certain areas, but it's become much less common. Criminal gangs now are actually targeting, unfortunately for the tenants who are vulnerable. This is a much better way to do it. So no, not really. I don't think you can say that squatting has anything to do with drug den or drug dealing.
I think we've got some confusion here that a lot of drug users have not only drugs for themselves, but they also get drugs for friends. And so the distinction between being a drug user and a drug dealer is not as clear cut as maybe the authorities would like to make it sound. So you hear drug dealer and you think of somebody sort of driving a Mercedes or whatever. Actually, most people who are convicted of dealing have terribly small amounts, and they're just supplying one person or a couple of close friends, and that's it. So while you may hear about the squats being used for drug dealing, technically that is correct, but most of the time it's not a drug dealing operation in the sense of the sort of thing you would see on films and sort of big stashes and the millions of pounds worth of drugs. It's not that sort of thing. Then squats are not used for that.
Back to you anyway, Ben, from Bristol Housing Action, Bristol Squatting Group. What are your thoughts about the morality of it, though? Because, surely if someone owns a building, it's theirs to do what they want. Why should they allow someone to get in through the back door and live there scot-free? And, I'm sure there's many people out there who are paying mortgages and rent who are very annoyed about squatting.
Well, first of all, if you own a property, you have a social responsibility. If you were in the way of a, God forbid, a multi-story highway or project, you would not simply be able to block that because you own property. You have a wider responsibility to society. It's important to remember that people who squat empty buildings in general. So the person who owns that property has somewhere else to live. As Paul has just pointed out, often people have properties which they, for some mysterious reason, we'll go into to later, leave empty. So why are they doing that? Why are they basically hogging the available property in a time of housing crisis? Why are they excluding the desperate?
Well, it's
so
not,
the moral, the morality is the other way.
It's not necessarily a mystery, though, is it? Because for many people now, particularly with these questionable economic times and questionable stock exchange, people have decided that actually property is quite a good thing to invest in. And if they want to invest in property, then they may wish to sell it. And in order to sell it, they've got to make sure that it's empty.
Well, this is where we run into conflict with a system that values property and commodities over people, isn't it? And we exist to make sure that the main thing of humanity is respected, people are respected, property is a secondary thing. We are very sorry to property developers if we get into their empty property, but they must remember that there are thousands of people living on the streets, young people, people with illnesses, people with problems, and as Paul has already pointed out, it's immoral to leave those people out on the streets when they could simply get in out of the cold.
But can't you understand people who are paying rent and paying mortgages being irritated and annoyed by someone who moves in as a squatter next door and is paying nothing?
Well, I pay rent, other people pay mortgages, they're doing that to get a roof over their head. Why should you be upset that somebody else in a desperate situation simply takes a different pathway?
Now, there is another aspect to all this, and that is when quite a lot of squatters get together, maybe 10 or something, and they create something which is called a social centre. Now, this is what they call it anyway. Now, this is a bigger building. So what happens at places like that? We had somebody from a place called The Factory in Portland Square here a few weeks ago talking about that. So Isn't that something that's growing in the city? Do you think there are more of these larger squats, which are at least called social centres, where there's some sort of shared space?
Yeah, I mean, the idea of a shared space is that you can make use of an otherwise undeveloped building, usually bigger than a residential property, and you can do more creative things with it. The most, if you like, prestigious development is the Island, which was the ex-police station, and that's got an agreement with the developer for a certain number of years to use it as a circus and other training space. These places can be very creative. You're doing things that people with limited resources couldn't do. It's very expensive to run a big building, do training courses. In the rents can be very expensive. So it's good that people can get in and make use of otherwise undeveloped areas, for example, art projects or teaching people. Some of these places are very obscure and peculiar, I won't name names, and others are really open and welcoming to the public. So there's a wide range of these social centres now in Bristol.
Paul, can I come back to you now, Paul Hazelden from Crisis Centre Ministries, run the Wild Goose Cafe on City Road. Can you tell us, with all your experience of this, how would you tweak the system? If you were, say, the Home Secretary or you were Prime Minister, what ways do you think that the system needs to change in order to make sure that we don't see homeless people sleeping on the streets in Bristol?
Well, one very good starting point would be to provide enough homes for ordinary people. You know, we've got lots of hostels in Bristol, and the hostels are full largely because there are not enough suitable places for the people in the hostels to move on to. We have a housing crisis in Bristol.
Now, there is actually a programme at the moment that Bristol City Council are talking about selling off quite a lot of the green space to build homes on it. Do you think that will help?
To a limited extent. I mean, I'm not keen on building on green spaces in Bristol. I think we need to preserve the heritage, but I think there's a lot of derelict land. There's a lot of land that could be developed without impinging on the green spaces. So certainly providing more homes is absolutely key. The next question is, what sort of homes are we providing? And the way all the calculations are done, we talk about housing units, and you provide so many housing units, but that doesn't tell you how many bedrooms are provided. It just, so a bed sit is a housing unit, as is a five-bedroom family house. So having targets for the number of units that are provided really doesn't make a lot of sense. It doesn't help you understand what the need is or what's being provided. It just helps you keep track of one aspect of the situation, which is the number of distinct property addresses you're dealing with, which is interesting, but I mean, there's a lot more to it. So we've got to understand what types of properties are needed, what size, how many bedrooms, and what localities are they needed in. And of course that ties in with transport around Bristol, which everybody recognises, you know, a major problem. We need better public transport so that people can get, you know, around the city, and if they could get around the city better and cheaper, then the different places would become sensible to live in, and so you could spread the housing more effectively. So those are a number of starting points anyway.
Thank you. Now, do local authorities actually have a legal duty to house homeless people? Because I know they certainly did a while ago. It seems as, you know, there are quite a lot of homeless people around. So is that out the window now?
No, they still have an obligation to house some homeless people. But which homeless people they have an obligation to house is in some ways restricted. So
I suppose it's restricted by the number of places that there are in hostels and those sorts of things.
No, no, no. Their legal obligation is essentially set out in legislation. So it's got to be people who are not intentionally homeless, for example, and you can find yourself being intentionally homeless without intending it.
How's that?
Well, by making mistakes and you know, not understanding your situation well enough and...
I mean, you could be a woman that's been in a domestic abuse and you can't convince the council that it's serious enough to leave your home in a panic. That's happens quite a lot.
So is this quite common, do you think, Paul, that people are made intentionally homeless unintentionally?
It's not the major problem we face, but it's certainly one of the issues. And then another really significant issue is the folk from the new European Union countries who are coming to the UK looking for work, and they have no recourse to public funds. So if they are homeless, the council are not allowed to spend any money helping them. So, you know, we've got these people on the streets and the public services can't help them by law. Isn't that brilliant?
Okay, back to you, Ben Ritchie from Bristol Housing Action. Is it your experience that there are increasingly Europeans that are being housed in squats as well?
Yes, I mean, exactly as Paul said, they aren't able to get into what was called council housing or social housing. And with the recession, there are more and more people who can't find any work and they find themselves on the streets. So, yes, it is.
And what about the sort of history of homelessness in Britain? Because I know for, if you're looking at the bigger picture, and this is, you know, this is a big picture we're talking about here, but historically, everybody pretty much in Britain had somewhere to live until the land enclosures, the privatisation of land over centuries. Yeah. And that was fine, wasn't it, whilst we had healthy, thriving industries and we had an industrial revolution where people could easily get a job. I mean, I know certainly back in the 1960s, you could apparently, anyway, although I was only a child at the time, you could walk out of a job on Friday and find another one on a Monday. Do you think that this is also a problem now, that because jobs are so much more difficult to find, that this is going to become an increasing problem? People simply don't have anywhere to call their own.
I think you've got to remember that since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, there's been a housing crisis. It's about conflict between making money and providing adequate housing. And if right back in the 1840s, Engels in Manchester found appalling overcrowding in Manchester in the new cotton industries. And this has been a recurring theme throughout Britain. We've always underinvested in housing. It's never been given any serious thought. If you go over to places like Germany and Austria and look at their public housing and see what standard they have and then come back here, it's just eye-opening. It has got a lot worse, but it was appalling after the Second World War. I mean, you probably know about the people who came back from the trenches and the war and found that they had nowhere to live, and they went and squatted in great big groups in Nissen huts. It then got a little bit better in the 50s with the council house building program, and then as the crisis developed later on in the 60s, the problem picked up again, and squatting became much more common in the 70s because of these underlying economic problems.
And Paul, can you say, you know, give us your impressions about this, and particularly with this current economic crisis we're having? Surely, you know, your job must be a real headache, because things are not going to get better soon, are they?
Absolutely. The problems are getting worse economically, and while that doesn't immediately mean that there are more people on the streets, it does mean that there is much less help for people, and it means that the people who have got jobs, who have got accommodation, are under increasing problems and stresses, and their situation is increasingly fragile. And so you get more people becoming homeless because they can't cope with the stresses and the pressures that they're under.
Now, how will your ministry on City Road cope with that? Are you geared up to cope with an increase in homeless people?
We are doing the best we can with very limited resources, so we help everybody who comes to us, but of course the amount of help we can offer depends entirely on it's partly the finance, but it's largely volunteers, and we get our volunteers from the local churches, and we are expecting to increase the number of volunteers from about 140 at the moment to possibly around 200 in the next few months as we move into larger premises, and hopefully that will help us to work with more homeless people and to be more effective at helping them get off the streets. But that's the plan. Whether it comes off, we don't know yet.
Okay, your larger premises, where is that intended to be? And you're actually moving out of the place on City Road, are you?
Well, we are moving the Wild Goose coffee shop from City Road to Stapleton Road, and it should happen sometime in November.
Now, Martin Summers, Old Labour Oxford economist, is joining us too. Martin, how do you think this fits in with the economic crisis? Am I over-egging the pudding a bit here, saying that this could mean an increase in homelessness over this winter and over the next couple of years?
No, I think it's been made clear by what Paul's saying, that the potential for things to get worse is clearly there. But I think underlying all of this is the attitude towards property and home ownership in Britain, which goes back to the 1920s. For political reasons, home ownership has been encouraged in Britain, which leads to a situation where people leave university, as it were, or they qualify, they get on the housing ladder, and basically they end up, as long as the property market is rising, they end up getting a load of free money. Effectively, this is their pension plan, and it amazes me how many middle class people who go on about benefit scroungers and cheats and all the rest of it, this free money that they get is their free money, and they don't notice. In actual fact, of course, housing prices ought to be stable. It's just one of those things. I mean, in other parts of Europe, as Ben was saying, basically house prices don't rise that much because it's designed to be, you know, supply and demand are brought into balance, and people expect, you know, if they're business people, they expect to make money through setting up companies. I mean, I used to live in Fulham, and you saw people in the 1990s where the value for the house price rising in a year was far more than they were earning even in the city. And this is massively irrational. It's very unfair, but it's also massively irrational. And if you're thinking about why we're in this mess, why is Britain in particular in a mess, it's because everything is run around what I call the inflationist block in the southeast of England. It's all to do with property prices and the interests of estate agents. And DIY is very big in this country. We're very big on conservatories, but we're not very big on making cars anymore, are we?
But you can't expect people who've made a fortune as the property prices have gone up to support your concept there, can you?
No, but they've been empowered to make money through investment in property. The overinvestment in property is what causes property bubbles. And then this, of course, we've now got this whole subprime mortgage problem this whole obsession with home ownership, even for people who haven't got sufficient income to buy a home, has led and the selling on of those loans to third parties and fourth parties further down the line. This is very irrational. And you see, we were talking earlier with Kerry McCarthy, the MP, about the cuts policy and so on, but you can see that property prices, for example, in Scotland, Northern Ireland or Wales are lower. And the political domination of the outer London suburbs and the wealthier suburbs of outer London is completely it's got a stranglehold on what goes on in Britain. If you want to win elections in Britain, you've got to win Basildon, you've got to win these kind of these, and those people want to see their house prices rising. Now the problem is that we've got used to this idea that everybody owns their own house, which of course that's not true, and in fact most people don't. In fact, ever, you know, they've got a mortgage, which means the bank owns their house, as they're going to find out once they lose their job. They don't own their house, but it's not a very rational way to run things. It's very unfair. It leaves loads of people at the bottom with nothing, and of course many young people end up with nothing. I mean, I remember in the 80s, suddenly when benefits were withdrawn from 16 to 18 year olds, suddenly there was a whole load of young people on the streets, and it used to make me really angry to see these young people sleeping on the streets. Totally unnecessary. It's cruel, it's socially divisive, and it's also irrational. Why is it we can't compete? It's because we're obsessed with home ownership. We're not actually building a better widget, are we? We're too busy building our little castles in the sky.
But isn't there a sort of cold logic to all this, that people who are actually efficient, hard-working, will get themselves a nice house, and people who are inefficient and aren't working hard will simply have to be homeless?
No, because what happens once you're on the housing ladder, as long as you're on it, it's a one-way bet. And that's the problem, is that the middle class have got used to having that one-way bet. You know, where's my free money, is the attitude. And of course there is no free lunch. If the middle class get this massive subsidy to their housing costs, which is basically what it is, so they get mortgage tax relief on their first home. They don't pay capital gains on it. Perhaps they ought to pay capital gains tax on it, because that would start to knock. I mean, we need to knock these bubbles down. The bubbles are the problem. Everybody wants to see another housing bubble. That's the last thing we really need. We need to reform housing policy so that we can actually have an efficient economy. But of course there are massive vested interests blocking this. But once we go into this crisis and crash, and middle class people start losing their homes, then they're actually going to, their minds are going to be opened, hopefully.
Well, why does it make economic sense to provide housing for people who simply either don't want to or can't work?
Look, the fact of the matter is that you've got if you're going to have a capitalist society, you're going to have a variety of different levels of income. Some people are going to be wealthier than others, and some people are going to be poorer than others. Now, if you're going to have a capitalist society, maybe one third of the population are never going to have an income which will allow them to buy a house or even possibly to rent a house. So you have to provide them with housing or put them on the street. Now, the other alternative is not to have a capitalist economy at all, but to have some kind of planned economy where we don't allow people to buy their own homes and all the rest of it. Now, if you're going to have a free market economy, you've got to provide social housing. It's absolutely essential underpinning. And that's the problem. We're trying to have a free market economy without the social housing, and that's why we're ending up with a mess.
Now, Paul Hazelden from Crisis Centre Ministries and the Wild Goose Cafe on City Road, I see you nodding there. Do you think that there are reasons why some homeless people, even though there is the welfare state there, Social Security is there, simply don't have access to it for one reason or another?
There's a lot of people who can't get access to the benefit system that is supposed to be there for everybody. A lot of people are not in a position to cooperate the way the system says that they've got to. So they are effectively excluded from the help that, in theory, is available to everyone. Now, whether they could be assisted to cooperate, for many of them they can be, but it's not easy. It takes time and it takes patience, and it's not a cost-effective thing to do.
And what do you find is the role of the police in homelessness? I mean, do you find them relatively helpful and cooperative? Or, I mean, I would imagine some of the people who are homeless are also very frustrated and could possibly be committing crimes themselves.
A lot of the folk we work with are committing crimes. We're aware of that, and that's one of the difficulties of the area of work we're in. That said, we have very good relationships with the local police. We have the local police community support officers who come in and visit us on a regular basis, and the local constabulary are very supportive and helpful whenever we have contact with them. So they work with us as much as they can, and they are cooperative and supportive and friendly, and they bend over backwards to be helpful because they want to do the best for these folk. That doesn't help them at all to create antagonism with the homeless community.
Because that's a bit of a fine line, a bit of a tightrope you're treading there, isn't it? Because you may find that if you've got relationships with the police are coming in, police community support officers, etc., that the homeless people simply won't trust you.
Yes, it is a very difficult tight line to walk, but we've got to keep on good terms with the police. They're absolutely vital, and equally well, we've got to maintain the trust of the folk we work with. And yes.
Okay, now, are the police themselves, though, sometimes breaking the law as part of a clampdown on squatting? Are they manufacturing suspicions of serious crime, such as burglary, as an excuse to break into legally occupied houses by squatters and get the squatters out that way? Now, one case in point took place 6 weeks ago on Thursday the 26th of August in Fremantle Road in Cottam. The full armed might of Avon and Somerset Police was brought to bear. An armed response unit, helicopter, dog units, film units, undercover CID and several van loads of constables. Three squatters were arrested, two on suspicion of burglary and one on suspicion of criminal damage, and passports were seized. But once they'd been taken out of the building, the squatters were released, and all bail conditions and charges have now been dropped due to lack of evidence. The three squatters involved are now considering whether to sue the Chief Constable of Avon and Somerset Police for unlawful arrest. Now, Ben, you were called by one of the squatters and went to Fremantle Road in Cottam 6 weeks ago or so and witnessed this eviction, which was being run by Inspector Burgess and Sergeant Allen from Bridewell Police Station. What did you see there?
Well, I saw in progress a full-scale police operation. Basically, there were at least 20 uniformed officers in the garden. Outside in the street were squatters and members of the public, many police cars. I believe there were several CID or even special branch officers in the crowd. There were eventually dog units called. Some police were armed. People did see police with pistols. The helicopter was called. So what I saw was a full-scale police operation to a squat that had already been in existence for 2 months, with the squatters in some form of negotiation with the woman who was looking after the premises for a mother who's in hospital. And I should say that her mother was never intending to come back to the building. The squatters were sympathetic to the situation, and apparently the woman involved was more or less okay with the people being there. So there may have been a change of heart on her part, but it did look very much like the police had set this up as some kind of training exercise, because there were at least four different police stations from across the city involved.
Now, how long did this police operation actually take then?
About 2 hours, largely because there was an awful lot of protest. School children became involved doing their dances, and builders came from across the road. So they, out of nothing, the police made up a very difficult situation for themselves, which we didn't really understand why they were bothering to do this, because the woman could have always just gone to court, got them out, and had been out within maybe 2 weeks. So we asked the police why are they doing this. In fact, people were actually saying to the police, this is just an operation, isn't it? You're training, aren't you? They didn't reply to this.
Now, I did actually request for an interview with Inspector Burgess from Bridewell Police Station, who was running that operation, apparently. But unfortunately, he wasn't able to be interviewed today. I did actually only call earlier on today, so that may be why. But the police have given us, in fact, Niamh Byrne, who's a police spokesperson up at Portishead, has given us a statement. The police were called to an incident in August where the owner of a property reported that it had been broken into using forced entry, causing damage, and property had been removed from the house and placed outside. The initial response and police presence was very low-key. Unfortunately, officers were met with a resistance by a group of people occupying the house who began to throw missiles, assaulting officers and posing a danger to the officers as well as to members of the public. Our response, therefore, had to be revised to deal with the situation appropriately and proportionately. There was also a large crowd of onlookers, I would imagine Ben was one of them, that gathered quickly, making it necessary for us to make provisions for crowd management and maintaining a cordon to keep people at a safe distance. Three women were arrested on suspicion of burglary. Once the situation was contained and the building had been emptied, the police presence was immediately withdrawn. It is the role of the police to uphold the law. If reports of any offence, including criminal damage and forced entry to a property, are made, it's our job to look into it and use proportionate and appropriate action and resources to deal with any situation that may arise. Now, Ben, most immediately, it does surprise me that if there was property inside the house of the landlord, why it might have been taken outside the house? Because, I mean, I would have thought if the landlord wants to get their property back, then they should actually keep it inside the house and look after it until they were there ready to collect it.
Well, no property was taken outside the house. This is just a lie. As a burglary and a police response to it, this is a very disturbing response rate of 2 months. So if anybody has a house broken into, you can expect a full police operation within 2 months of this break-in.
Well, just to reiterate, the police statement does say that that damage had been caused and property had been removed from the house and placed outside. Okay, well, you just did. Ultimately, though... don't you think the police do have a duty as well to have a look at various different occupations of houses and to make a decision on whether that they believe that actually some criminal activity is going on? And sometimes it's just simply occasionally these things are going to happen and the police are going to decide, I'm afraid those squatters are outside the law and we're going to have to arrest them.
No, this was clearly a predetermined police operation with a fully developed scheme. The police knew the people had been there for 2 months. They'd actually been in contact with these people several times. The landowner had also been in contact with them. There was no burglary. There was no criminal damage because the people walked in through an open door to their great surprise. So this is simply a question of both the police carrying out an illegal eviction and lying to cover their tracks. Now, this, I must say, fortunately, is very rare, but this was the worst possible case I've ever seen in Bristol.
So you're saying that this sort of thing is, you know, very rare and this, you've not come across this kind of thing
it
before?
It happens about once a year. Now, we don't know why the police do this. We believe that this is coming down from the highest possible level, probably involving the chief constable.
Well, it's certainly quite a big operation like this. I would imagine the chief constable would have to sign it off, wouldn't he?
Yes, and we wonder whether the chief constable has a personal axe to grind in this situation. It doesn't make any sense whatsoever. Usually, if the police are called to what looks like a burglary and they find squatters, people are sitting in there, not moving property, they basically accept that people are squatting. They have actually occasionally become... unhelpful, if you like, to the squatters, but they don't normally carry out full-scale police operations involving armed raids.
Anyway, after having heard the statement from the police, let's now have a listen to one of the squatters who wants to remain anonymous, who was actually living in the squat at the time.
We were clearly made homeless on no legal grounds whatsoever. We are to some extent used to it. Squatting brings it. The police were around the house 2 times before that actually happened, and we got told by a police officer that this was a civil matter, so it was a rather big surprise that they actually turned up and started evicting straight away, because we were told earlier that this was a civil matter and we assumed that it would go through court as it usually does with squatting.
What actually happened?
The owner turned up earlier in the morning, claimed there was criminal damage done to the front door, which is not true. Called the police. We were in the house for several hours. Police turned up, accused us of doing criminal damage, and were told that we had to leave the house. Refused to do so because there was no criminal damage done. These accusations are just plain wrong. A bit later, more police turned up with breaking equipment, started to evict us. It was an illegal eviction, it was a forceful eviction. The police have done a lot more damage to the house than we have done at any point. We haven't done any damage to the house. Actually, we fixed things that were broken in the house to make it livable. Cleaned out the whole basement, which was a pile of trash, literally. There was a lot of damage done to the front porch due to the very forceful entry of the police. It's a rather unknown tactic, and we were not prepared for that eviction whatsoever. We usually move out before the eviction team arrives anyway, because there is no point in staying if you have to go by law. 2 people have been arrested, and charged with burglary, I think, and attempt of criminal damage. So, which is, well, ever heard of a burglar that moves into a house and stays there for several weeks, moves all his or her stuff in there, and then waits for the police to drag them out? Seems rather illogical to me.
Well, that was one of the Fremantle Road squatters there. And I just want to correct something he said. I mean, apart from the fact that he said there were two arrests, there were actually three, is that there was were no charges brought, that the squatters were arrested on suspicion and they were bailed, and then they were told that there would be no charges because there was insufficient evidence. Anyway, this is a bit of a worrying development, isn't it? And I mean, I actually sent in to the police about 3 weeks ago a freedom of information request just to see if I could find out how much this operation had cost to evict the squatters, and was told that actually they didn't keep costs. But I've done my own calculations, and it is probably something in the region of between about £6,000 and £7,000 of public money spent on evicting these squatters. Anyway, we shall keep an eye on this case, because the squatters are considering suing the chief constable for wrongful arrest. But this isn't necessarily going to help those who are homeless tonight in the city. And going back to Paul Hazelden, can you just tell us exactly what kind of services you provide at the Wild Goose Cafe? You said it's a lunchtime and an evening thing. How many nights of the week do you manage to run this? And what times?
Okay, we operate, as I say, Monday to Friday, basically from 11 a.m. till 2 p.m. during the day, and then 8 o'clock till 10 o'clock in the evening. And we're serving food during those times, but the purpose of serving food is to get people to come in so we can get to meet them, we can get to know them, we can listen to their stories, find out where they are, find out what they'd like to see change, and then we can try working with them to see those changes happen. And for many folk, there's small changes initially, but if you keep working with people and building up trust, then eventually you can see significant changes in their lives. But it takes a significant investment of time and energy to get to the point where people trust you enough to enable you to help in that way.
And going back to Ben Ritchie, Ben, once squatters have actually managed to get into a place, how does it work with the things like getting the water, electricity, all those kinds of things working? Because I would imagine some squatters are paying for electricity and others aren't.
Well, what we ask people to do is to live as normal life as possible. So if they have their own abilities or friends who can help them with water and electric, they get on with it. We recommend that people register the electricity use that they make, and it's up to them how they do that. So that covers them in any situation where they might be challenged on that.
Right, because it's actually a criminal offence, isn't it, to steal electricity?
Exactly. So you have to be certain that you know what you're doing, and that you've taken down the numbers of the meters when you enter and are prepared to pay the bill.
And what about water?
Water has to be supplied, fortunately. Some squats have no water. Neighbours are often very helpful on this, and usually people finally get the water put on after some months, maybe.
I mean, isn't it a bit dangerous in a squat to be using the gas and electricity?
Gas, we don't normally recommend people do anything with unless they've got a Corgi registered person on hand, because it's extremely dangerous. Electricity, less so.
And can you give us an idea of the sort of quality of squats? I mean, I imagine some of them are actually quite clean and tidy, and others may be pretty messy.
Well, some people live, as Paul's already said, live in normal homes, which you wouldn't recognise in the street because they've just had a lucky place to go into. Other places are much more damaged when people go in, and they're basically living in a converted warehouse. But usually people do their best to live as comfortable a life as possible.
And can you just tell us about your group? When do you meet?
Well, we'll meet every Monday at the Emporium Art Gallery, 8 o'clock. That's 37 Stokes Croft. And those who are homeless are welcome to come along.
Now, you also run a free shop, don't you?
Free shop's next door. Yes.
Okay. So this is all on Stokes Croft, on the left-hand side on the way up Stokes Croft. And when is the free shop open, and what's that about?
The free shop is open Thursdays, Fridays and Saturdays, 2 to 5. It's about recycling unwanted goods and making sure that people who don't have access to items that they can't afford may have a chance of getting hold of them. It's a bit of a lucky dip, but there are some amazing things in there.
And where has this free shop idea come from?
I think it was developed mainly in Germany, but as far as I know, there is a free shop in New York.
Well, that's all for this week. Thanks very much to our guest, Paul Hazelden from Crisis Centre Ministries on Stokes Croft, and Ben Ritchie from Bristol Housing Action Movement. Next week, the bloggers take over Bristol. We have a preview of the Watershed's weblogging conference taking place in a fortnight's time. Until then, thanks very much.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a